In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
Almost 4 months since a Hamas terror attack and Israel's increasingly deadly response to it created a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. We still have startlingly few reports of what life on the ground in the region is actually like day to day. It's dangerous and it's deadly, we know that. Tens of thousands have been killed by Israel's army, thousands of them children. We see new numbers on that every day. Maybe that's part of the problem. It has been so difficult to get accounts from Gaza out of the territory, through the blockades, and into the global media, that this war has too often been reduced to numbers, not the people behind them. The one place where firsthand evidence on the ground from Gaza is available is social media. And those platforms have been so flooded with misinformation that even seasoned journalists have struggled to verify those accounts. But there have been a handful of people who were there in Gaza on October 7th and in the days that followed who have since escaped the region. They can explain what it's like to live, or try to, amid the daily horrors. And they can also explain what a lot of the information we are getting about Gaza gets wrong or leaves out entirely. Today's guest is one of those people. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Louis Beaudoin-Larman is the communications manager for Palestine for Doctors Without Borders. Hello, Louis.
Hi, Jordan.
Thank you for finding some time for us. I'm sure this is a chaotic time, to say the least.
Thank you for having me.
I know that you've written about this, and it might not be great to keep recalling it, but I think people would like to understand what happened the day this all began. And you were already in Gaza on October 7th. Maybe just start by telling us about that day. And how, as somebody who's worked there before, you knew it was different from other days?
Yeah, of course. This is what happened on that day on October 7th. It was a Saturday, I remember. We were sleeping in a bit more than usual, but it was quite early. I would say maybe like 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. And all of a sudden, all these whooshing sounds took over the auditive space around us. It was all the rockets going off. I didn't actually hear the first rockets go off because I was very sound asleep. In my case, what woke me up is that after a lot of rockets took off, my head of mission shared this guest house with us in Gaza City. He woke up right away when the first rockets took off, and he turned on this app that he had on his phone to turn on an alarm that would go like, rear. And that's actually what woke me up. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I woke up from this alarm sound that he was blasting from his cell phone, going around the guest house to wake everybody up, that's when I heard all the rockets going off. And it was just like this really loud sound, like I said, like a whooshing sound, just like of just like hundreds and hundreds of rockets taking off. And the way we knew that this was not normal, we figured this out quite quickly. Our experienced head of mission figured this out for us. He just noticed that there were a lot more rockets than you would normally have going off taking off from Gaza towards Israel. And also he noticed that these rockets weren't aimed at the nearby kibbutzes or communities next to Gaza in Israel. They were all headed north towards Tel Aviv. And so essentially that showed us that there was something unusual going on, much bigger than anything we had been used to, at least in our experience in Gaza.
What do you do in that situation when you realize this is like nothing you'd encountered before?
In that case, I mean, we have a protocol at Doctors Without Borders. We all immediately went down to the safe room on the ground floor. It's a room that is closed and there are iron shutters to prevent any kind of like debris or, you know, pieces of cement from explosions to kind of fly through the windows. We opened the windows to avoid them from essentially exploding with the explosions from the strikes. The strikes didn't happen right away, but we figured that with so many rockets going towards Israel,
right,
the response would be quite strong and, if not immediate, very swift. So the first reflex was to gather everybody. So this is a guest house in Gaza City, to give you an idea, in the Rimal neighborhood, just a stone throw away from Shifa Hospital, which was the biggest hospital at the time in Gaza City. And so this guest house has a lot of international staff for MSF who are either based in Gaza for, you know, between a month and a year. And you have also people like me who were based in Jerusalem and visiting Gaza every now and then to visit the project, to see how everyone's doing and to kind of report essentially on MSF's work in Gaza.
And the days following October 7th, what did you and the team do? And I guess my question is, when you're in that kind of incredibly dangerous and overwhelming situation, like, where do you start helping with the needs that you're seeing? Like, how do you organize that kind of effort?
So that was actually a very complicated part of it all, particularly for my medical colleagues, is that very quickly, essentially, as international staff, there was not that much that we could do ourselves because we were stuck in this guest house. We had like a security protocol to follow. And also we didn't have very much medical supplies. So I had a lot of colleagues who really wanted to go to the hospital and help out, but it was just a whole different system from the one that they had been brought into Gaza under. And so this new protocol essentially didn't have space for these foreign medical staff. Now, our Palestinian staff, MSF employs around 300 people in total in Gaza, at least before the war. So the Palestinian staff, a lot of them chose to voluntarily go and work from the hospitals, at least until the situation was figured out. Eventually, after a month, MSF was able to send in international staff. But at first, in our situation, the main thing to do was stay put, gather information, try and make sure that everybody's okay, whether that's the international staff or the local staff. All this in an extremely difficult situation because communications kept on going on and off. There were communications blackout all the time. It's a very unusual, unprecedented situation where just to make sure that one of the people that you work with is alive is in itself a whole very complicated endeavor.
A lot of what you do is try to get information out and tell the world what's going on, right? I mean, as the communications person, that's a big part of your goal. How do you go about it when communications are so unreliable? And what was that experience like for you and others to try and accurately convey to people not on the ground what was happening?
It was very complicated. We had to get a little bit creative. MSF has a lot of people all over Gaza working. And so the idea is always to try and figure out a way to get in touch with them and to get them to witness what they're seeing for us. And so regular phone calls often didn't work. WhatsApp calls didn't work either. We had sat phones, but maybe the people we were trying to get in touch with didn't have sat phones. So usually most of the times, the way that we did things is that we would send messages to nurses, surgeons, any kind of medical staff, drivers, anyone who's out there doing something in Gaza, being like, okay, I hope you're safe, first of all. But then also, okay, what are you doing? What are you seeing? And so this was what's a bit easier with MSF, say, rather than in journalism, is that these are all people that we know and trust, right? They're our MSF staff. So when we know that they're at a certain hospital, say, Al-Auda Hospital in the north of Gaza, we can ask them, okay, what are you seeing? What are your conditions? What are the conditions of the people that you're seeing as patients? And so then we send those texts and usually we work a lot with WhatsApp audio notes. So they would send us, you know, whenever they would receive our message and have enough internet to send out a message, they would just record, you know, a 1, 2, 3, 4 minute long message. Mm-hmm. And then we would kind of like analyze that, share it, of course, with the operations staff, but then also with the world by either sharing voice notes with journalists or just synthesizing the information and kind of sending it out to the world however we could. There's a lot of people who can support us, who were able to support us outside of Gaza. So, you know, we would get one voice note or one text, try and verify the information and then send out that information to explain to the world that, okay, they are like every day there were like more more people displaced within the enclave, that there were more shortages, first of medicine, medical equipment, and then fuel, and then eventually water and food. Because it's an extremely unusual situation where no journalists are going in and no journalists are going out. So the usual communications pathways that you would have in a conflict just don't really exist. I met a journalist recently who had just arrived in Jerusalem, and he was like, oh, I'm just going to try and, you know, make my way into Gaza. And he just didn't realize at all that Gaza is a 40 kilometers by 12 kilometers enclave that's fully surrounded by walls and essentially unbreachable, especially for a journalist. So essentially it falls down to those who are already inside to send out the information. And in my particular case, it was also hard to do my own work because we were also focused on trying to stay safe.
Right.
You know, we were always on the move. We were displaced about 4 or 5 times. And so we're trying to do all these things, you know, also trying to stay safe and to keep our Palestinian colleagues safe, because you can't just like reveal everyone's location. There are a whole bunch of things that you have to take into account.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
I don't know if you would have seen much of it, given, you know, how difficult it was just to get information out. But I wonder what you think of the reaction, I guess, to the information that gets out, that you've gone to such great lengths to verify, that people have taken on such danger to get to you. And then it kind of goes out into the wider media ecosystem, and there's skepticism and doubt, and nobody knows what to believe.
Right. So, I mean, while I was there, I didn't really have a good idea of what was going, like what the information ecosystem looked like outside. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm outside and I see what's being said and how the media is portraying the war, I feel like there's a lot of airtime for Gaza and for the war. I do feel like it's hard for people to get a good idea of what exactly it's like for Gazans right now. What the living conditions that they're in are like, because the news cycle gets a little bit caught up on just reacting to every horrible event that happens. So we can get caught up on, you know, like a military incursion in one city or strikes on another city, and just kind of get stuck into the cycle of enumerating deaths and things like that. Whereas it's really like the war is affecting everything, every aspect of life. So right now in the south of Gaza, you have 1.5 million people displaced in an area that used to have 300,000 people, and all the infrastructure is gone, and there are shortages of everything. So, you know, all this overcrowdedness, it's creating shortages of everything, partly also because not enough trucks are able to go into Gaza right now. But then people, because they're all stuck together, are starting to spread diseases, communicable diseases. So it's not just about, you know, fractures, open wounds, or other kind of war-related wounds. What should be simple diseases like diarrhea or the flu or fevers that people are spreading because of the terrible living conditions that they're stuck in as displaced people living in tents all over each other. People don't have enough access to clean water, to bathrooms. So that's also how all these things spread. And in many cases lead to death simply because all the health structures are functioning only very partially and with not enough medicine, not enough medical equipment. For example, in Nasser Hospital, we have some colleagues who have been working while there was an evacuation order around the hospital. Nasser Hospital is in Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And they reported, for example, that they don't have enough abdominal gaze, which is essentially a cloth that you use to get blood from people who are injured. They don't have enough abdominal gaze, so they're reusing the abdominal gaze. So they use it on one patient, and then they kind of drain it of the blood, they wash it, they sterilize it, and then they use it on another patient.
Hmm.
And it's all those things, it's just a series of problems that are compounded in one by the other, all because of the war essentially happening on this very small perimeter, and everybody's stuck in there.
Right.
For me in particular, right now, we talk a lot about the quality of water, and I'm just always thinking about the latrines because while we were there in Gaza, it was already getting pretty bad in some of the camps that we were in, just a lot of people sharing toilets. And since then, since I left Gaza on November 1st, things have just gotten so much worse. Like so many more people have been displaced. So much more infrastructure has been destroyed. You don't have sewage, you don't have like water pipes, all those things. And people just have to live with that because they're stuck.
How do you cope with a daily existence like that? I mean, how do you live with that omnipresent threat of airstrikes and death, as well as, as you described, just the incredible difficulty of getting the necessities of life? Like, what do you see people doing and how do they handle that? I think you mentioned a concept that I'm probably going to mispronounce called Samud.
Yeah. So Samud is this concept that I used to think was a little bit overused by NGO and expat types in Palestine. It means resilience, and it just refers to the ability of Palestinians to just cope with the hardships of the occupation in the West Bank or the blockade on Gaza. And it's just used very, very often. But during the war, I felt like the word was really appropriate because no matter what was happening, as soon as it was safe enough to do so, people would just adapt to the situations. People would get to a place and just find anything to create a shelter, to find water or food, help each other out. At the end of the day, there's no choice. If bombs are falling, you have to try and go where bombs aren't falling.
Mm-hmm.
Except in Gaza, that's very complicated because it's a very small space and bombs are falling in a lot of places. And because telecommunications are also a hard thing, it's always hard to predict where will be the safest place. But regardless of all that, people are able to just survive as best they can using their ingenuity, their creativity, helping each other out, building shelters out of wood, pieces of metal, anything that can be used. Because everything is lacking, everything needs to be repurposed in one way or another to cope with needs. We have a doctor in this hospital, Nasser, actually, in Khan Yunis, who mentioned that he was just looking for wood to create beds out of for the hospital, or crutches. They're just out there fighting what they can to make the things that they need.
How did you and your team eventually get out and get to safety?
So eventually, we had left a camp in Rafah that we had been in for 2 weeks because things were getting a little bit complicated there. It was the first days of there not being quite enough food, so people were starting to get tense, and things obviously have gotten much worse now. But anyways, we left this camp to go to an area called Al-Mawasi. It's close to Rafah in the south of Gaza by the sea. We were ready to stay for, maybe several weeks because at this point we had no idea when we would be able to get out. But one night we got the word that we would be able to go. In my case, I was just woken up from my sleep once again, the same way it started. I was woken up from my sleep by our friend who was a French archaeologist, René, who just woke up the surgeon who was sleeping in the same room as me and said, "Alexandre, let's go, wake up, we're going." I just heard this in my sleep and I thought, okay, this is the moment when we're going to go now. And indeed, we all woke up around 4 a.m. and we were told, okay, there's a list of 400 people who will be able to cross out of Gaza through the Rafah crossing into Egypt. And our names are on it. So we will try to get to the crossing by 6 a.m. and cross. And then that was a whole long day. It was really terrible saying bye to our Palestinian colleagues at the border crossing who had to stay behind. Some of them have been able to leave since then. Others have not. But anyways, at this time, at that point, we said goodbye to our colleagues. And also there were just thousands of people trying to exit through the Rafah crossing into Egypt. But there were only 400 names on the list. And it was the first of several lists. Eventually, like more people were able to leave, but almost always only the people who had another passport. So binationals, you know, like people who had like a Palestinian passport and a European passport or from any other country, really. We were the first ones to be able to get out. It was a very long day and very, very trying and also very sad because of all that we saw in terms of people trying to get out, but not being able to.
Once you made it out and returned, I guess, to whatever, you know, semblance of normal life you could have with your colleagues, so many of your colleagues still there, what did you think of the quality of information? I know we talked about what kinds of things are missing from that discussion, but we've done an episode before on just like how unreliable so much of what we see on social media is when it comes to this conflict. And I imagine part of your job is to look at that, and you must look at that flow of information and then the flow of information you're getting from people in the organization who are on the ground. And like, how do they compare?
There are so many things about Gaza out there, about the war being said. Like I said, I think it would be better to be able to cover this more in depth. But since there are not that many journalists running around the enclave, it's not really possible for people to go beyond kind of the first news that come out. There are a lot of false things being said about the war in Gaza. There are a lot of things that are very bit manipulated to give not necessarily the right image of what's going on in Gaza right now. But there are some sources out there that are able to report at least on the basic facts. It's just the main problem is that with the blockade of Gaza, there's just not enough information able to get out for people to be able to get like a good idea in detail of what it's like.
Last question then. What do you think organizations, news organizations could be doing to give people a better sense of what's happening there? And, you know, I think everybody knows there's a ton of reporting on this. And to your point, it's a lot of numbers and dire headlines. What does the world need to understand about this that they're not getting right now?
I think the world needs to realize that every part of the war, at least the humanitarian aspect of it, is connected, right? So you have the displacement, you have the shortages, you have the attacks on healthcare. All these things kind of come together and kind of compound one another to create like a really terrible situation for Gazans who have nowhere to go because they're stuck in this place. And it's, I think if this was like a different conflict, you would have a lot of people reporting on this, on all the human stories, all the human tragedies happening in Gaza, but because nobody is able to get in or out, or at least not very many people, and particularly not journalists, the facts that come out about the war, I find them a little bit cold and kind of lacking humanity to kind of truly describe what is the situation like on the ground. So that's why it's very important for anybody who's able to get out of Gaza to really speak out in media, to talk about what they saw. Because there really aren't that many people who are able to get out to witness all this.
Well, thank you very much for speaking to us about it, and hopefully others can as well. Louis, thank you again.
Thank you, Jordan.
Louis Beaudoin-Larman, Communications Manager for Palestine for Doctors Without Borders. That was The Big Story. For more from us, you can head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also let us know what you think about this episode or any other, or request an episode if you think you have a topic that we should look into. The way to do that is via email, hello@thebigstorypodcast.ca, or with a phone call and a voicemail, which you can leave at 416-935-5935. The Big Story is in every single podcast player and every single smart speaker. All you got to do is ask those smart speakers to play The Big Story podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.